Good morning, everyone. This is Vin DeCiani from Affiliated Monitors, and we have a very interesting podcast and conversation today regarding consumer protection divisions at AG's offices and some of the issues that come up there. With us today are two special guests, Chris Allen and Megan Stoppel from Cozen O'Connor. Chris has a national practice with a particular focus in the areas of consumer protection, antitrust, data privacy, and the False Claims Act. He also does work outside of the AG's office practice at Cozen, where he represents consumer products manufacturers and distributors and a wide range of investigations. Megan Stoppel is also part of Cozen's state AG's practice. She has a background both in private practice now with Cozen, but also a deep background in experience at two consumer protection offices. She was recently with the Nebraska Attorney General's office as the chief of the Consumer Protection Division. In that role, she was responsible for investigation and enforcement of state and federal laws related to deceptive and unfair trade practices, data privacy and security, antitrust, nonprofits, and many others. And now at Cozen, she is part of their state AG's office. Also with us this morning is my colleague and friend, Jesse Kaplan. Jesse, too, has a deep background in state government. He serves currently as the managing director of Affiliated Monitors Corporate Oversight, where he monitors conditions imposed by organizational clients by government agencies. But prior to that, he has experience about 20 years in government, working with most recently before he joined Affiliated as general counsel for the Massachusetts Executive Office of Health and Human Services. And he also served for a period of time as the head of the Attorney General's Office of Massachusetts Consumer Protection and Antitrust Division. So it's a great group that we have with us. And I thought we would start by turning this over to Megan to talk a little bit about consumer protection divisions, what they do, what tools they have for enforcement, and those kind of things. So let me turn it over to Megan.
Thank you, Ben. And thank you for having us on this podcast. Chris and I are delighted to join you today and talk about not just state AGs, but our state AG practice. And I actually met Jesse and you, Ben, earlier this year in Raleigh. And it's always such a thrill for me to find former AAGs and folks who've practiced in the AG world on the government side and found really creative and rewarding ways to stay connected to this community. Because as you mentioned, I have spent a good part of my career in this world, and it's such a rewarding way to practice law, and there's so many great people doing this work. But to dive right in, I think, Ben, and get to your question about, you know, consumer protection divisions more generally and what they do, and thank you for that kind introduction. From a 10,000-foot perspective, most consumer protection divisions, and I think we have to caveat all of these comments today with, a quick, not every state is the same and they're all set up a little bit differently, but most of those divisions are going to be tasked with interpreting and enforcing their respective state UDAP laws. And UDAP laws are just a shorthand way for us to refer to state unfair and deceptive acts and practice laws. Those are those consumer protection statutes that prohibit deceptive trade practices, unfair trade practices. And to accomplish that, many of those state AG offices and their consumer divisions have assumed over time a handful of sort of other ancillary obligations, right? They might mediate complaints that they get from their constituents against businesses. They might do outreach to consumers to educate those folks about their rights, about scams and frauds that are happening in their community. And then what they're trying to do generally is just raise the profile of the office, inform constituents that the office exists, that they take complaints. And the reason for that is so consumers know to report to them potential cases or violations of the law to the AG as appropriate. But it is important, I think, to keep in mind here that these divisions and AG offices more generally have a variety of resources at their disposal, right, to identify potential enforcement actions and targets of those actions, right? That does include consumer complaints, but that also includes, you know, just run-of-the-mill things like media reports, stuff they see on the news, and also information that they get from other regulatory agencies, right? The Federal Trade Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, maybe even USDOJ or local law enforcement in their state. So hopefully that answers your question, Ben, and is a nice high-level overview. And Chris, feel free to weigh in if you have anything you want to add there.
No, I think Megan, you addressed it very well, and I'll start also first by thanking you again, Ben and Jesse, for having us on here. You know, I've met your team. I've known you for several years now. You have a great team with a great reputation, and it was really nice to reconnect with you in Raleigh, and we appreciate that leading to this podcast. So thanks for having us on. I think, you know, in addition to what Megan, to expand just a little bit on what Megan talked about, the unfair deceptive acts and practices, or UDAP laws, that these AG's offices enforce are very, very broad. They prohibit, generally speaking, deceptive, misrepresentative, false statements to consumers, but they also generally prohibit unfairness. And so what this provides AGs and consumer protection divisions are at the tip of the spear of this are really broad, diverse, flexible tools for protecting consumers in their states. And so a lot of people may hear unfair deceptive practices and think of, oh, it's a company, you know, defrauding somebody, saying, we'll fix your roof, charging you $4,000 and then never showing up. And that happens. But what AGs have been able to do is take these laws and really apply them across a broad panoply of consumer behavior. I'm sorry, business behavior, commercial behavior that impacts consumers. And so I think a really cool example of this is data privacy. You know, AGs were the very first enforcers in the United States to develop data privacy as a consumer right. And the way they did that was not through any kind of special statute, but by enforcing their own UDAP laws and saying, you know, if you say you're safeguarding a customer's information and you're not actually doing that, that's a false statement. And it allowed the AGs to become the de facto national regulators in that area. And it's also that same flexibility has provided them the ability to be leaders in a lot of other areas, healthcare, finance, the gig industry. All of these are areas where AGs have been able to use this broad power to uphold the interests of their citizens, but take action to defend the public interest across a really wide area that touches on basically every business that's out there.
Yeah, and I'll sort of pile on to that, Chris, and maybe it's helpful at this point to talk about the differences and how the states approach those industries from an enforcement perspective and how sometimes they work together, right, to set those standards using their UDAP statutes, right? From an enforcement perspective, you know, sometimes we'll see a state conducting and resolving a state-specific investigation, right? A matter that's specific and unique to their state, either because the business is located there or they've received a number of complaints unique to their constituents. But more and more, we are seeing states act in highly coordinated fashion, right? And the epitome of that coordination is what we refer to in our practice and what sometimes the press will refer to, and events I know what you refer to as the multi-state, right? Where a number of offices join together to conduct that investigation and then take some sort of enforcement action in response to their findings. Those investigations, those multi-states, can vary in size. Sometimes you're talking about 10 to 12 states, led only by a handful of states. Other times you're talking about 40, 45, even 50 states in the multi-state with an executive committee, a leadership committee consisting of, you know, upwards of 10 states. And, you know, I think it depends on the subject matter that you're talking about, right? As Chris alluded to, data privacy is certainly a hot topic these days, and we're seeing more and more states step up and play an active role in that space particularly. And you know, sometimes the same states over and over again in a leadership capacity in the data privacy realm. But I do think it's important to keep in mind that the states can coordinate when they want to sort of set that national standard, because those UDAP laws have so many sort of hallmarks. They are similar enough across the board that they can act in that coordinated fashion to set sort of a de facto national floor.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, Megan, also what you've seen also develop with this dynamic of multi-states is that you do have individual state offices that have developed either a reputation or a role as leaders in specific areas. So in data privacy, for example, you often will see states like Connecticut, Maryland, Illinois taking a leading role in coordinating their other states, as well as bringing their own actions in those fields. You have a lot of AG offices that have developed specialized divisions. This tends to be more the case in bigger offices. But for example, you will have states like New York and Illinois where the AG's office has specialized healthcare divisions. You'll have states like Pennsylvania and California and Massachusetts that have divisions that focus on financial protection, so debt services, credit, things like that. And then you have states that really just, I would say, tend to take a natural leading role in multi-states. They serve in the executive committee, which tends to be, you know, a collection of anywhere from five to even a dozen states that act as the core negotiating and leading group for up to 50 states, like Megan said, in these multi-states. And you see sometimes big states like Florida and Texas take a leading role, but you'll also see smaller states like Connecticut have a large voice. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Nebraska, despite not having a whole lot of people there, is a real leader in this area too. I think in no small part, thanks to my former adversary and current colleague Megan's role there.
Chris, appreciate the shout out there. And you know, and I think, you know, your comment there, Chris, actually is probably a nice segue towards mentioning the fact that, you know, in a smaller office, right, you might have divisions that are filling multiple roles, right? So like when I was in Nebraska, our consumer division, we had multiple silos within that division that performed different sort of enforcement tasks, right? Antitrust responsibility was within that division. Nonprofit regulation enforcement was within that division, but we also had traditional UDAP enforcement authority. But there are other offices that don't have that sort of umbrella authority within their consumer division, or they're somehow more siloed, right? They may have a separate antitrust division, a separate privacy division or privacy unit. But even in the smaller states, I think you do see some traditional siloing, right? Most offices have a civil division. Most offices have a criminal division. Most offices have a Medicaid or healthcare fraud division. But I think for this audience, it's probably really important to keep in mind that just because there appears to be sort of functional segregation within an office, whether that office is large or small, it would be a mistake, I think, to assume that the AG's office is unaware of how one division's work might impact another division, right? Chris and I know from our experience, and Ben, I know you know from your experience, and Jesse knows this as well from his time probably in an AG office. AGs wear many, many hats every day, right? Sometimes they're the attorney that's defending the state. Sometimes they're the attorney that's actually prosecuting the case on behalf of the state. And in my experience, AGs are often quite aware, sometimes painfully aware, right, of the impact that taking a position in one matter is going to, how that's going to impact the work they're doing in another area. And there is a tension there sometimes. And oftentimes executive leadership is trying to resolve that tension or manage that tension. And so, you know, I think sometimes our responsibility, Chris and I's responsibility in dealing with our clients is helping our clients understand that. But, you know, I do think most AGs understand that is their obligation to break down those silos as much as possible. And obviously that's easier to do in a small office, but it's interesting. We're actually seeing the federal agencies, right? Like the FTC start to speak publicly about their efforts to do more of the same, right? To break down those walls between their consumer protection efforts and their antitrust enforcement, which I think just goes to show sometimes how state AGs can be a real leader in these areas, right?
Sure. Let's turn over to Jesse. Jess, any comments on what we've heard so far before we turn it back to Megan and Chris about an AG practice in a law firm?
Yeah. And, you know, following up on what Megan and Chris, particularly what Megan was last talking about the different hats that a state AG wears, you know, before I joined the Massachusetts Attorney General's office, I worked for the Department of Justice in Washington in the antitrust division. And when we were investigating whether it was a merger or conduct, we were focused on one thing and one thing only. What were the competitive impact, implications, effects of that transaction? It was only really after I joined the state attorney general's office that I really appreciated the different areas of responsibility that a state AG has and the different areas of oversight. And I'll just give an example. And then I'd love to hear how, you know, Megan, you and Chris and your practice, how you do counsel your clients in this respect. So for instance, at the state AG's office, if a large hospital system, for instance, we start investigating them because of either an antitrust issue or maybe a consumer protection issue, we couldn't just focus on, or the office couldn't just focus on what were the competitive implications. Because, for instance, if they were a very large not-for-profit, the state AG's office also has oversight over them as a public charity and needs to make sure that the charitable assets are you know, not being wasted. The AG's office also has concern over the labor and employment practices. And if they're a very large employer, you know, what the AG's office does in connection with investigation could have an impact on the employees of that organization. The AG's office also needs to take into consideration whether the state Medicaid population of that state are going to continue to be serviced by that healthcare system. And so there's all these different parts. Sometimes the answers are consistent, sometimes they're not. And I'm interested, Megan, I'll turn to you, Megan, you know, how, you know, do you, it sounds like you do agree with that, but how do you counsel your clients or help your clients navigate those different interests that the AG's office may have?
Great question, Jesse. And I think probably the easiest or best scenario for our client is where we can explain to the client that those potentially conflicting interests that the AG has or the tension that might exist within an AG office, like the one you just were referring to there with respect to, you know, antitrust and workers, right, and labor and employment considerations, how sometimes that tension can be used to the client's advantage, right? And I referred to executive leadership earlier because I that's an important point. Oftentimes it's the middle management within the office or the folks in the front office and the leadership ranks that are aware of that tension. The staff, the attorneys that are in the trenches, right, doing the day-to-day work, are not always aware of that tension. And we wouldn't necessarily expect them to be, right? They don't have visibility into what those other divisions are doing and what their sort of prerogatives are, right? And so sometimes what we'll be able to tell our clients is we need to go, you know, not necessarily above the staff attorney we're working with, but I think we need to bring into this conversation someone who has visibility into these other areas of the office so that we can have a broader based conversation with the AG's office about those potentially conflicting interests and how we ensure that we're not creating unintended consequences, not just for the client here, but for the state. And you know, that's a delicate conversation to have with the state AG's office. And I think it's one of the reasons why you've seen the growth in state AG practices, quite frankly, because you need a practitioner who's who knows how to navigate that conversation. And again, make it very clear to that staff attorney or attorneys you're working with in the trenches that this is not about going above your head, right? This is about expanding the audience, right? And making sure you have all of the right viewpoints and perspectives at the table for the conversation. Chris, feel free to weigh in and add your perspective. But that's the best scenario for our client when we can use that tension to our advantage.
Yeah, totally. I, Jesse, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No, I know. But I have a question for you, too, that I think kind of follows up on what Megan had to say. And that is, so, you know, the expansion of state AGs, their practices, particularly in consumer protection, now, you know, kind of in parallel with that, Cozen O'Connor has started your state AG practice. And I'd love to hear from you, because I think you were there at the beginning or close to the beginning. You know, what prompted your firm and you to start that state AG practice and a little bit of what you do in that state AG practice?
Well, thank you. I wish I could claim that I was there at the beginning or that I was entrepreneurial or innovative or insightful to found this practice. But that really goes to our two co-chairs who Megan and I work with, Cozen O'Connor, Bernie Nash and Lori Kalani were really the visionaries behind this. Bernie was earlier in his career counsel on Capitol Hill. And instrumental to the passage of the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act, which revitalized and transformed antitrust law in the U.S. And one of the things that it did was it gave a significant parallel role to state attorneys general. And so as he was doing that, he made a lot of contacts and gained a lot of expertise in this area. And after Bernie left the Senate, this would have been in the 80s. He founded his own law firm and found himself drawn by those connections back into this world and had the insight and the wisdom to recognize that because of what we've talked about, the broad power that AGs have, as well as one thing we haven't really talked about is the discretion. A state AG is one person. And many of them, most of them are elected, fewer appointed, but still it's one person sitting at the top of an office with this very broad power. It's not an FTC of five people. It's not a DOJ with all of its massive layers of bureaucracy all the way up to the White House. It's one individual that can really make a big difference depending on what they decide to focus on. And so Bernie founded a practice that came to focus exclusively on understanding state AGs, understanding the differences and nuances of them, and learning how to build the kind of trust and develop the kind of practices and methodologies that help us to serve our clients with state AGs and take an approach that's very different than civil litigation or litigating against US DOJ. And then after Bernie had been in his practice for a while, he was joined by Lori Kalani, who was former in-house counsel at Dish Network, where once they became the target of a consumer protection, some consumer protection concerns, she developed a plan to go around and meet all 50 AGs. And she did that. It took her about 2 years. But she realized that, again, this is a very unique niche area of law that's built on trust. It's built on understanding. And so as AG's influence has grown, which it has over several years, our practice has grown also. So as AGs have realized that through these multi-states that Megan talked about, through their flexibility, through these broad powers, they can act as regulators on a national scale. We also, as a firm, have scaled up. And we now count 16 attorneys, including five that are former members of AG offices. We have a former Virginia Attorney General, a former deputy from Wisconsin, and former AAGs from Virginia and Massachusetts. And then, of course, we have Megan, who is the former consumer chief in Nebraska. And what that's allowed us to do is really bring to the table the full services that you need to deal with an AG's office. That is knowing the AG is the front office and staff, having a reputation of trust. I think that's paramount. And really understanding the nuances and the special concerns that go beyond really just the facts of the specific case and go to what you, Jesse, and Megan were talking about. In an AG office has different, the concerns are overlapping. There is an idea, there is a philosophy that tends to be in an office, and understanding where an AG is trying to do, not just legally, but also politically and policy-wise, is critically important to being able to manage these issues. And so, you know, we provide those services for our clients across all 50 states, both in individual state cases brought by AGs, as well as these multi-states. Our practice transcends subject matter, which is something that's kind of fun for me. You know, I joke that I one of the guys I was a summer associate with became an insurance lawyer and had the same litigation for 8 straight years. I would have jumped off a bridge at that point. Whereas in this job, I get to do consumer protection. I also get to do antitrust, data privacy. I've dabbled in securities and environmental cases. I've done a lot of false claims work at the state level. And that's just touching on other things that AGs can get into, like you mentioned, Jesse, employment, labor, charities. But we really do it all. We help our clients respond to AG investigations. We help them negotiate resolutions. We do litigate. So we have been defense counsel to entities, companies, businesses that have been sued by AGs. We help them with policy and working with AGs to develop areas of shared interest and find joint projects. But really, you know, what we specialize in, I think, and where, again, you all come in and your reputation is, I think in many cases, you know, companies want to resolve issues with AGs or avoid issues altogether. They want to demonstrate that they are good actors, that they have strong compliance programs. And that's where people like affiliated monitors can really come in and help, because you can provide a voice, a verification that the company really is taking those matters seriously. And I don't want to get ahead of ourselves there, but I do think it's worth calling that out, that you know, we try to find creative solutions to these kind of problems. And there are a lot of tools we have at our disposal because AGs have a lot of flexibility at theirs.
And when, as you say that, Chris, you know, one of the things that attracted all of us on this call together is this conversation that we were having about alternative kinds of sanctions, right? And not just the fine or putting a company out of business or what have you, right? And one of those considerations that we bring to the table, as you noted, is independent monitoring. And I'm interested in getting your and Megan's comments on that kind of thinking, and whether or not it would be attractive or is attractive to AG's office, Consumer Protections Division, as an alternative. And you know, have at it, because we're very interested in hearing your thoughts.
Yeah, I can lead off on that then, and thank you for the question. Certainly monitoring was something I was familiar with, you know, both as a line attorney who started in consumer protection sort of right out of law school, and then eventually as a consumer chief, saw that theme in a number of settlements, typically multi-state settlements. I think it's important for this audience to understand that monitoring is something that state AGs are going to be probably more open to considering when you're talking about, you know, highly regulated parties, complex injunctive terms, right? And oftentimes you see those two hallmarks in multi-states, not always. And I'm sure Ben and Jesse, you could talk about cases that you've settled with individual states where monitoring was appropriate. And I'd be interested in hearing your perspective on that. But in my experience, I saw monitoring in multi-state cases. But to take a step back for a minute, I mean, I think it's important to understand that, you know, AG investigations and that conversation with the AG is just a different animal, and the way you speak to an AG needs to be handled differently than the way that you might speak with or have a conversation with a private litigant or a private party, and probably even differently than the way that you're going to talk to a federal agency like DOJ, as Chris mentioned. And there is that room for creativity. And I do think the, one of the reasons for that is not just sort of the statutory ability to be flexible, right? There's nothing in most of these UDAP laws that dictates the outcome be a certain way. But that creativity flows from the relationship that exists between the parties oftentimes, right? When you see trust and when the state AGs and the lawyers at the table for the state AG trust the representative who's sitting there speaking on behalf of the client and believe they can have open and candid conversation about solutions, about what their concerns are. I think that's a scenario where you're going to be the conversation is going to lead more naturally to options like monitoring, right? And so I think that's important to keep in mind as well, right? You don't want to throw out an option like monitoring in a very contentious negotiation, because I just think it's going to be a more difficult lift for defense counsel. But I do think in some cases, monitoring is a great tool and can be especially effective, you know, in consumer protection matters, maybe in other matters like, you know, healthcare fraud or antitrust, for a couple different reasons, right? I mean, it gives the client a resource to ensure that they're complying with whatever those settlement terms are, but it's also going to give the AG comfort that the client has the tools, right, or the assistance to do what they're being asked to do under that settlement. And, you know, the AG and the client may not initially appreciate the need for monitoring at the outset of that negotiation or even the outset of an investigation. And that, again, is where folks like Chris and I come in, right? And bring that creative lawyering to the table. And this is where experienced AG counsel can be really helpful, because we can point to those, you know, precedential matters where monitoring was used and the effectiveness of it. But Chris, I'd be really interested in hearing your perspective, because I know you've dealt with clients who've agreed to monitors, and I would love to hear your perspective. And I think it'd be helpful for this audience to hear sort of logistically, how did that conversation come about and how'd you get that matter across the finish line? Was there resistance and how'd you overcome that?
Yeah, I think that it comes about, again, the whole idea is being creative. It's about finding ways to get around impasses without running to court or without going to the front office and saying you're stuck. Because like you said earlier, Megan, that's a very valuable thing to do. And that's something that we excel at given the relationships we've built. But you want to make sure that you really are exhausting all of the possibilities that are out there. And so when monitoring can be very useful, I think, is again, when you have a complex settlement where you're dealing with several different concerns from the AG's office, and you really want to demonstrate a client's commitment to coming into compliance if that's in question, or remaining in compliance if you're agreeing to certain obligations. And some of these consent orders or ABCs can be many, many, many pages and dozens, if not hundreds of clauses long. And so what struck me, and the reason I think we're all here, is knowing what Vin and Jesse do, knowing what Affiliated Monitors does, in being that kind of vouchsafe, in helping companies understand their compliance obligations, but also being able to tell AGs and consumer protection staff as you go through this monitoring period, hey, these guys really are in compliance. You don't just have to take their word for it. And I think that's a really powerful thing. It provides assurances to the AG's office that your client is taking this seriously and that they really do intend to live up to their obligations. And that, I think that's good for the AG's office too. They don't have to use their resources, their scarce resources, policing your compliance. They can rely on a third party. And that's, it kind of brings me to a question I had, which I've gotten to know you guys and Jesse as we've been preparing for this, but, you know, how did you get into this, and what are the stories from that third party? What is your perspective in terms of when you're brought into, you know, these kind of situations where you have a client on one side and a regulator on the other, and you are serving as an independent monitor?
So I'll start that, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jesse. But Affiliated Monitors has been around since about 2004. And it started because of an idea that I had when I was working as a defense attorney in your shoes. And I thought a creative solution to a difficult problem would be an independent monitor to serve almost like a civil probation officer to make sure, as you described, Chris, that the individual or company was doing the right thing with oversight, sort of validating what they were doing. And so we've been doing it for a long time, and we're doing more and more work with AG's offices in the consumer protection area and in antitrust. But we do a lot of different work providing those kinds of independent monitoring services. But I think Jesse can provide even a more valuable perspective because he's done it from all sides, right? He's done it from the defense side, he's done it from the AG side and the government side, but also as a monitor. So Jess, let me turn it over to you to give some perspectives on monitoring as we get ready to wrap up.
Yeah, and thank you. And I'll try to be brief. And so, you know, I joined Affiliated Monitors about 4 years ago. And the reason I joined is because I really do believe in the work that we do and, you know, in the value of independent monitoring. In my experience, and I've litigated on both sides, litigation is not always or often not a very good way to resolve things. Right. Yeah. What companies really want, and I know this is what you counsel your companies, I'm pretty sure, is that we want to have a resolution where the company remains in business, is able to remain competitive with the others in that industry, but also gets the matter behind them and allows the Attorney General's office to then reassign resources to look at something else or someone else. Okay. And offering independent monitoring as a solution, whether it comes from counsel for the company or from the government, can really check those boxes and get you there. And I'm just going to give a real quick example. And this actually didn't happen to deal with a state attorney general's office, but a case involving a company in the FCC on a consumer protection matter that we monitored and talking about creative lawyering. And that is, in this case, the FCC brought an action against this company for consumer protection violations. And the FCC was convinced this company could not operate lawfully. And they went in and got an ex parte TRO that basically shut the company down. Well, the company and their outside counsel were convinced that they could operate lawfully. And they went to the judge and offered a solution. Judge, allow us to continue to operate under certain conditions, and we will engage an independent third-party monitor to monitor that we are complying with those conditions and report to you, judge, on a regular basis. And the judge said, okay. So during the pendency of litigation, which is somewhat unusual, there was a monitor overseeing that the company was actually engaging in the conditions that they had agreed to. And in a period of about 9 months, we submitted probably close to half a dozen reports, and the company and the FTC actually ended up settling the matter. The FTC was apparently convinced that the company now could operate lawfully. And in fact, by settling matter, they didn't even require continuing monitoring. So that was an example where, the company and their counsel were able to actually get this resolved in a situation that looked hopeless at the outset.
So as we wrap up, any final thoughts, Megan and or Chris?
Chris, you want to take that first?
Yeah, no, I got to applaud you, Jesse. That is exactly the kind of outcome you want to see. And it's the kind of outcome that we try to achieve also, you know, for our clients. I think you said it very well. You want certainty. You want to be able to continue working, and you don't want the burden placed on you to be larger than the burden on the rest of industry. What I think is really interesting is a lot of times what an AG is trying to accomplish when they enter into a settlement with a particular company is also to kind of set a marker for what that industry should be expecting. A big piece of this are those conduct provisions and the company's compliance with that. And if an AG's office can be assured that a company can continue operating under these conditions, and somebody like a monitor can play an important role in ensuring that that happens, that allows them to go to the rest of the industry and said, you know what, I think consumers are best served when a company is abiding by these kinds of obligations and building their compliance around these obligations. And X Corporation is doing that. We think you should too. And that really allows AGs to use their investigative power to achieve the kind of the policy goals and the political goals that I think are very, very important to them. And so, you know, Megan said earlier something that I think it is worth emphasizing, you know, and please don't take this the wrong way, guys. Monitors are not a silver bullet. Nothing is a silver bullet here. But it's very important to think outside the box. It's very important to approach problems with flexibility and creativity. And something like the services that y'all at Affiliated Monitors provide just gives you another tool. It gives you another option that may help you get around that impasse, that may help you get to yes. And that, I just think that's one of the hallmarks of our particular practice area, is dealing with extremely complex, politically and policy sensitive areas where we really are all trying to get to yes.
Couldn't have said it better, Chris. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Ben and Jesse, for the opportunity to join you today. This has been a pleasure, and you know, hopefully we can do this again sometimes, or our paths will cross soon, hopefully on a particular matter. So thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Chris and Megan, thank you very much from Jesse and I and Affiliated Monitors. That'll end this particular podcast. Thank you. Thanks.